Welcome to False Flag Weekly News, the one and only weekly news show that keeps you informed about the false flags and other big lies that rule our world. I'm host Kevin Barrett, working with who is going to be our regular co-host, Professor Tony Hall. Professor Tony Hall is one of Canada's most important intellectuals, and in my humble opinion, perhaps even in his even more humble opinion, Tony participated in the False Flag Islamophobia Conference in Paris a couple of weeks ago, and he's done fantastic work on all sorts of issues, basically really re-envisioning the last 500 years of history from the standpoint of the indigenous peoples rather than the colonizers. And Tony is well-versed on the kinds of current events that we cover here at False Flag Weekly News. So, hey, welcome, Tony Hall. Thanks for coming on.
Well, what a pleasure to be here, Kevin.
Yeah. Well, I think that we're going to give the show a little bit more of a global slant here, not just looking at our own navels. USA red, white, and blue navel gazing is pretty much what most people south of the border do. I think that your position as somebody who's rethought history from this different perspective, one that actually includes a sort of a Canadian revision of U.S.-American history, is going to give us a slightly broader perspective than we've usually had in the past on this show.
Yeah, of course, Canada emerges from the conservative side of the American Revolution, and so what is being called conservatism in the United States is very different from conservatism in Canada. And, of course, you know, we share so much history, just looking at it from different perspectives. And really, you know, this 9/11 truth movement, which is sort of the roots and origins of what we're working on, you know, we really have to get a global perspective and use language and concepts that transcend the limitations of our national boundaries.
Absolutely. Well, let's go to the first story we're covering, which kind of touches on issues that you're focused on. Rocco Galati, a constitutional lawyer in Canada, is well known for his work trying to bring back honest, transparent currency to Canada and overthrow the rule of the Rothschild banksters, the same people that staged a coup d'etat in the USA in 1913 and seized power through their Federal Reserve Act. They've also seized power in Canada, but Rocco is working on trying to get the Bank of Canada back printing honest, transparent currency. And this ties in with his belief that Canada is a quiet dictatorship. It ties in with all sorts of issues. So tell us a little bit about that, Tony.
Yeah, well, Rocco Galati is, you know, he's a kind of a rock star lawyer these days, fronting very important cases, including this case on the Bank of Canada. And we're, could I say, fortunate enough in Canada to have a bank, the Bank of Canada, created in the Depression, that actually has the power to create this kind of currency, debt-free currency, and lend it interest-free to, say, the provincial governments or different orders of government for public works. And between the 1930s and 1974, this Bank of Canada operated in that way, and Canada had a great surge of building up public works and such on debt-free money, and the country didn't go into debt like we did after 1974, when under Pierre Trudeau, the system was moved. The Bank of Canada simply suspended its powers to create this kind of debt-free currency and ascribed to the Bank of International Settlements, basically the privatized central banking system associated with the name Rothschild. So that's the story in a sense, but he puts this in this particular video here in a larger framework. And of course, he raises a major event that brought together a person called Splitting the Sky, the Mohawk activist Splitting the Sky. Maybe you could introduce your viewers to Splitting the Sky and our mutual knowledge of Splitting the Sky, Kevin.
Well, probably many False Flag Weekly News viewers have heard of Splitting the Sky, who made big waves in the alternative information community several years ago when he tried to perform a citizen's arrest on George W. Bush. It was the first time that George W. Bush had dared set foot outside of the U.S. borders post 9/11, and Splitting the Sky was there, ready to wrap him up in handcuffs and haul him off. Unfortunately, the privatized security detail that was protecting Bush from justice actually arrested Splitting the Sky, and so he was facing heavy penalties for that courageous act, and that was a big story for quite some time. Splitting the Sky, a Mohawk activist from way back, famous for being the guy who was set up to take the rap for the Attica Prison Rebellion. They were going to execute him as the kind of sacrificial scapegoat for that prison, well, it's been called a prison riot, but it was probably an official guards riot, at least as much as a prisoner's riot. And since then, he kind of grew up and became one of the great voices of truth and justice, one of the great Native American activists. So we remember you, Splitting the Sky.
Yes, and he came into Canada in the 1990s, and we met in the context of the Gustavson Lake Indian War in 1995. And Rocco Galati refers to that, refers to his partners in his legal firm working on this case, which involved the Canadian government using landmines in an Indian war in British Columbia. And so I thought it would be interesting to start there. He points to this episode as part of a decline of Canada into a general state of dictatorship, sort of with elections. He also points to the Free Trade Area of the Americas event in 2001, where I ended up in prison. There was a huge amount of tear gassing of the opponents of the this particular trade deal that was then being constructed. In any case, Rocco Galati is very associated with the Bank of Canada story, and I think here at False Flag News, you know, the banking regime and the kind of vulture-like capitalist approach of these bankers that build up debt and sort of enslave populations through debt. This is an ongoing story, so we have this Canadian dimension of it, which might be interesting to viewers. And also we have this connection through Splitting the Sky, because when Splitting the Sky attempted his citizen's arrest of George W. Bush, you got very involved. You covered it as major international news. Cynthia McKinney got involved. Ramsey Clark, who was his lawyer from the Attica days, Ramsey Clark, former Attorney General of the United States, he got involved. It was a great big global story. It's part of this larger story that we have all these war criminals marching around the world with impunity. The law doesn't seem to apply to the higher levels of international crime. And this is one of the issues that we have to deal with. So I thought that this would be a way to show some of the connections between you and I and between Canada and these larger international issues.
Well, that's right. It's an international situation, the march towards a new world order, global dictatorship of the international banksters and their hired hands. We're unfortunately getting closer and closer to that. In our next slide, we see that we're coming up on the imminent publication of a new book questioning the Paris attacks and indeed the San Bernardino attacks. You can cross out this subtitle and replace it with Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino, because we're going to actually cover San Bernardino in this follow-up to the book We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. So this book is excavating below the surface of what really happened with these two Paris attacks and then the follow-up San Bernardino attack. And this ties in with what we were just talking about, Tony, because they're building a global police state on the scaffolding of Islamophobia, which is being triggered by this endless PR war against Islam. And the centerpieces of that PR war on Islam are these false flag events.
Yeah, of course, when you were touring Alberta with me just a couple of months ago, 3 months ago, and we ran into this zealotry of the Brené Brith trying to silence your presentation on the book We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. And of course, I have a contribution in that book, Witch Hunt on Terrorism. And it started to really occur to me that by disseminating wrong interpretations of 9/11 and all the false flag events that follow, this is really hate speech. Of course, you were being targeted by the hate speech unit in Edmonton, who visited our presentation and decided not to arrest you.
They flashed their badges, and they said that they didn't see anything wrong with my presentation, and so they weren't going to have to haul me off in chains for giving a book talk.
Yeah, but when you just flip it around and say all this wrong interpretation of false flag terrorism amounts to hate speech. Islamophobia is constructed. You know, it's a huge engineered psychological operation involving the manufacturing of Gladio-style false flag terrorist events, which is the sort of core theme of this show, I believe. And so I'm really looking forward to what we can come up with you as the fearless leader on this book project. After we did our false flag Islamophobia presentation in Paris, I got a body of material thrown over the transom into our boat of truth telling, and it contains very important information on prior knowledge of what was going on before the Paris false flag events.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that. We've got great information, much of it brand new, on these false flag events, both the recent Paris attack in San Bernardino. And moving on to the next slide, speaking of which, we got the news this week, and this isn't from some conspiracy theorist sitting on the corner tweeting it out to his band of five followers. No, this is the Daily Mail, one of the biggest newspapers in the UK, telling us that the police actually stopped this guy, the top terrorist of the recent Paris attack, as he was fleeing from Paris. They stopped him three times during the couple of hours after he fled that attack. When they pulled him over, he and his terrorist accomplices were smoking a big marijuana joint in the car, and the police said, well, that's not our priority. Two of the three stops, remember, this is occurring just a couple of hours, within a couple of hours after the attacks in Paris. Two of the three times they actually demanded ID from the guys in the car. And then they said, well, this isn't our priority right now to arrest you for smoking marijuana in the car. Go on your way. So you really can't make this stuff up. Fanatical, fundamentalist, Muslim terrorists repeatedly stopped as they flee the biggest terror attack in Paris history, at least since the official state terror attack on demonstrators in 1961. But these Muhammad Atta-style fundamentalist Muslims who are druggies and getting pulled over, smoking pot, and then just they're waved along on their way. You can't make this stuff up, Tony.
Yeah, and of course here we have big parts of our intelligence agencies, counterintelligence agencies, actually working with recent Muslim converts, assets, who are helped along to be involved either as patsies or maybe playing some role in these false flag events. And then you have other arms of government supposedly trying to catch the bad guys, catch the terrorists, who are, it's smoke and mirrors. Well, what do they really do? Well, we know there's billions of dollars passed out in this particular, this particular half of the formula. And we saw, for instance, a family, a British family of Pakistani background going off to Disneyland just yesterday, being stopped and prevented from going into the United States by Homeland Security. There's like nine little children. They're traumatized. They have to go back home. They're ready to go to Disneyland. But the system has deemed, well, these are the terrorists, whether they have to be stopped. So can you imagine you're 9 years old and you can't get on a plane, you're told you're a potential terrorist, how that would traumatize you. So you have this other side of the intelligence network, anti-terrorist squads, just doing these arbitrary actions to make it look like they're doing something, while the other side is helping these events to happen.
That's right. Yeah, these guys blamed for the Paris attacks just had free carte blanche to go back and forth across the border as much as they wanted. So I guess if you're a nice Muslim family who wants to fly to the U.S. to go to Disneyland, you have a lot better chance of getting into the U.S. if you've just committed a massive terror attack and are smoking pot as you stand in line at security. Moving on to the next story. Enrique Marquez, the guy who's been arrested for supposedly being involved in the San Bernardino attacks, is, he's another Muhammad Atta-style Muslim, apparently. His friend said that Marquez appeared to have foreknowledge of the San Bernardino attack because he was ranting about how there's a lot of Muslims in our own backyard just ready to go haywire and attack. But then again, Marquez was drunk. So, I don't know. He might have just been, wait a minute. Okay, once again, a radical fundamentalist Muslim, just like these 19 alleged 9/11 hijackers who are the biggest party animals in the history of the world that I've ever heard of, is drinking and spouting off ahead of time. I mean, this just doesn't sound like disciplined, organized, serious, radical, fundamentalist Muslim terrorists to me, Tony.
And speaking of disciplined, organized violence, what about these three shooters that were witnessed, these three military-looking, you know, highly competent, equipped, militarized individuals who were seen shooting on this event? I saw the report on CBS News. I mean, it's been reported on mainstream. Where's the
three large white paramilitaries?
Yes, these are, you know, they looked very organized. They looked very well trained. They didn't look like they'd been smoking pot and partying the prior night. They looked prepared for a violent episode.
And that's how these things work, of course. The pathetic patsies are manipulated, set up to take the blame, and more often than not, executed to keep them silent, while the professionals from Blackwater or whichever organization it may be are run the show, just like in Paris, where we had the large, white, muscular paramilitaries doing the shooting at the Belly Keep restaurant and then just disappearing from the pages of history. Over and over, we see this pattern. White paramilitaries do the act. We saw this with the Mohamed Merah shooting in Paris, in France, in Toulouse in 2012. That was neo-Nazis with neo-Nazi tattoos, white paramilitaries with neo-Nazi tattoos identified by witnesses as doing that shooting. It was later blamed on a pathetic brown-skinned Muslim. Same thing with Charlie Hebdo. We have an eyewitness report that the killers in the Charlie Hebdo offices had blue eyes. Obviously white guys, not these brothers, the Kouachi brothers that they blamed. And here, once again, the same thing in Paris, three white paramilitaries doing the shooting at Belle Equipe, and then they disappear. And in San Bernardino, multiple eyewitnesses testifying that there were three big white paramilitaries that did that shooting. Once again, Tony, I don't know, I think this is actually racist. It's like people can't even imagine that white people working for white-dominated governments would do this. We have to blame it on those dark-skinned foreigners.
And, of course, a big part of this whole setup is that so much of the privatized terror economy has been delegated to corporations. You mentioned Blackwater, but, of course, Blackwater is now called Academy, partly owned by Monsanto, which some see as a kind of pretty violent, aggressive organization, Monsanto GMO company, a glyphosate company. What is Academy? What are these mercenary armies? What is their present status in relationship to this current swath of false flag events?
Well, they're the ones doing them, in my humble opinion. And I think the military, of course, is playing a role as well. We know that with Operation Gladio, the U.S. military ran that through its deniable assets. And now we've got troops rolling down the streets of San Bernardino. I guess that's what this is really all about, building a global police state on the back of Islamophobia. Well, Tony, let's move ahead to Nigeria. There was a horrific massacre in Nigeria. Hundreds of people were murdered by Nigerian troops, and they made this spurious claim that it was because that there was some assassination plot, which obviously would have nothing to do with these people in a religious procession going on a pilgrimage. And it turns out that it looks like the real trigger for the killing was that these Shiite pilgrims were in the street. And so they were ordered to get out of the way and stop blocking traffic or something, and then that was used as an excuse to just mow them all down. So this is one of the worst massacres in recent memory. And, of course, it's not going to get the play of the Paris massacre or the San Bernardino massacre because I guess it's only white lives that matter. What do you think?
Well, Nigeria is a very volatile situation in that about half the population, I believe, are Muslim, and very quickly growing. You know, Islam is very popular in Africa south of the Sahara, and there's a lot of inroads being made. I think on a larger picture, this global war on terror, it sort of provided many countries with a pretext for the ruling power group to characterize their enemies or possible challengers as terrorists. And so it provided a rationale to keep in place and entrench the power of, you know, the elites everywhere. Francis Fukuyama wrote a book called The End of History, and the whole sort of underlying premise of this global war on terror seems to be whoever has the power now, that's the legitimate bearer of the power. inheritor of the power, and history's at an end. You know, the elites will just use this demonization of their enemies to discredit them and hold on to the power and the wealth sources that entrench this power.
Right, and we got a pretty good analysis along those lines from Global Research with the story, Boko Haram, another al-Qaeda terrorist entity used to justify U.S. military intervention in Nigeria. And I think that that's a good example of the stuff that we've seen at Global Research, pointing out that Boko Haram is, many Niger. I think the polls show a majority of Nigerians realize that Boko Haram is not a legitimate, bona fide radical Islamic group. It's yet another of these ISIS-style fake mercenary armies posing as radical Muslims designed to legitimize crackdowns like the one that we just saw. And ironically, of course, this massacre of people in Nigeria was directed against Shia Muslims, who are the furthest imaginable Muslims away from the Boko Haram or Tekfiri-style ideology.
Yeah, we've got a lot of stories coming out of Global Research this week, and rightfully so. Michael Chalsadowski, of course, is at the University of Ottawa. That's his background. And so Global Research CA is quite a contribution coming out of Canada. And this particular article, you know, really this map that's on the screen right now demonstrates this pattern of instrumentalizing the imagery of Islamic terrorism. The phrase Takfiri mercenary armies came up in my imagination the other day. Takfiri, of course, is Muslims who fight other Muslims, and they're presented as if these organizations are motivated only by religious zealotry, only by a certain set of ideas, when in fact they are mercenary armies. They are funded and armed and do what they do largely because they're paid to do it, they're directed to do it, and they're directed to do it by Western governments, by the United States, by Israel, by Turkey, by Saudi Arabia, you know, Qatar, all the NATO countries. But I think what we really have to get into as well is that they're funded a lot now by corporations, oil corporations, pipeline corporations, corporations like Academy or Mercenary, you know, the Blackwater Mercenary Army that we talk about. It's a terrific overview of what's going on, Michael Chalsadowski's article here.
Indeed. And over in the Middle East, it looks like ISIS, which was created, sustained, funded, and armed by the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the regional allies of the empire, may be reaching the end of its run. There are some indications that policy is shifting, and the big story this week was the U.N. Security Council has adopted a resolution on the Syrian peace process, a resolution which actually drew agreement from the U.S., Russia, and other nations. We could be moving towards some kind of a settlement. And John Kerry said there may still be some differences on whether Assad remains, whether he goes, whether he has an election. But it looks like there's a shift. And the next story shows what the gist of that shift is. Kerry actually says that the U.S. is no longer seeking regime change in Syria. Tony, are we reaching a change, a major turning point here in the Syria story?
Well, the Syria story really is at the heart of the global geopolitics right now. Bashar Assad, his regime, of course, it was backed by the Soviet Union in the days of the Cold War. Bashar Assad, who took over from his father, actually has provided Syria with a pretty stable central government, and interestingly, a government that is more on the secular side. And it seems that powerful leaders in the Arab world who can provide kind of stable government for diverse sectarian populations, ethnically diverse populations, as Syria is, they don't seem to be allowed to stay in power. So this attack on Assad's government is a part of a well-established pattern to take out those kinds of stable governments and replace it with a more chaotic situation, a more balkanized situation, and you know, exploiting the imagery of Islamic extremism to advance certain agendas. So Assad becomes symbolically very important to me, that he survived this and that his government survived that. Symbolically to me, that's really basic.
And it may be that this change in policy, if it's real, is happening precisely because the Russian intervention has been militarily successful. And that's at least the view of Russia Insider, which published this story that Washington is panicking that Putin is breaking the ISIS supply line. So maybe they're giving up on perpetually destabilizing Syria. Who knows?
Well, to me, this will go down in history. Putin's intervention in this part of the Middle East, the way he intervened to say, okay, you guys are all talking a line about being at war with ISIL, but you're actually backing them, and your corporations are working with them, and Turkey is working really closely with them, and Saudi Arabia is providing the weapons, and so, you know, you're just play acting at making war on them. In fact, you're advancing their interests and using them in these different ways and setting them up for future types of negotiations. So Putin intervenes and actually makes war on ISIL or Daesh, and you know, sort of exposes this whole fraud around a false flag terrorism. And to me, it's becoming so clear that Daesh or ISIS or ISIL is constructed by the so-called West. And it really puts into question, well, it goes back to 9/11 and the creation of this imagery of Islamic terrorism that is exploited, that the great mother psyop of all of this was 9/11. And so we're sticking with that story, and we're going to make great headway in the next weeks, in the weeks ahead, because what's being exposed about Daesh puts into question the whole psychological operation that has got
and
so...
And what's really behind it? Whose interests are being served here? A lot of folks would argue that it's ultimately the interests of expansionist Zionism, the Likudniks over in Israel, the people who are trying to create a greater Israel, which will include precisely the territory destabilized by ISIL. And guess what? This week we got a report from the UK Daily Mail that the Israelis are rescuing people from ISIS, from the Syrian war zone. Israel has basically put it right out front that these are our allies, that ISIS is, in fact, the Israeli Secret Intelligence Service. And we've seen over and over these kinds of indications that the Israelis love ISIS. But Tony, it's interesting when the Daily Mail actually confirms that.
Yeah, and I see a great big ad, Dairy Pure. So Israel trying to sort of improve its public image by taking in some of the refugees. But let's put this in a historical context. Could we see the depopulation of the territory of the Greater Israel as a kind of extension of the Nabka, 1948, of course, to establish the nation state of Israel? There was a removal and an intimidation and violence projected against the indigenous Palestinian population, forcing them to leave the region. And so could we see the millions of uprooted Syrians and Iraqis and others who are seeking refuge in other parts of the world now as a continuation of the Nabka and a depopulation of the indigenous Arab population from a part of the world that is slated to become, if present patterns continue, part of this greater Israel? Of course, Israel has no real clear eastern boundaries, and it seems pretty clear from the settlement movement that the agenda is to do what the United States did, which is just keep going into the West. Israel, just a frontier settler society, just keep going into the East and creating this greater Israel, which has been the policy of the Likudnik party, the particular party that Benjamin Netanyahu represents, and goes back to the Irgun and the Stern Gang and the bombing of the King David Hotel. This particular part of Zionism, this particular very extreme part of Zionism, which doesn't really want to negotiate with the indigenous peoples, more wants to eliminate them.
Good point. Well, it's not just Israel that's helping Daesh or ISIS or ISIL or whatever you want to call the fake Islamic State, but Europe and Turkey are actually closing their borders to Russian bombers fighting against Daesh. So we've got the whole West essentially the ally of this horrific extremist supposedly Muslim group that we're supposedly fighting over there. The Orwellian factor is going off the charts.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really, this makes it so clear, and this underlines the point I was trying to make about this historic move of Putin to sort of enter into a theater of psychological operations, of smoke and mirrors, and actually do war on Daesh. And here, by responding in this way, Europe and Turkey close airspace to Russian bombers fighting Daesh, demonstrating clearly that Europe and Turkey are allied with Daesh. They don't want Daesh to be eliminated. That they're doing rhetoric and they're doing events like the Paris false flag or the Ottawa shooter event in October of 2014 or San Bernardino. I mean, it's always based on this all-purpose new Muslim boogeyman now called ISIS. Isn't it interesting? It has such a nice, simple name, and it happens to be the same name as the Mossad, ISIS, the Israeli Security Intelligence Service. Anyway, Russia is exposing this lie, and I think it's become so important and incumbent upon us to run with this lie, and this is the importance of this show and what we're talking about right now.
Okay. Well, the next story is from the BBC. They found that a third of the rebels share the same war aims as ISIS, the fake Islamic State. Personally, though, I think that that is a deceptive report. The real issue here isn't so much what they claim their aims are, establishing a caliphate is the alleged claim of so-called ISIS, but in fact, I think that this is part of a false flag strategy, Tony. I think that these people behind the so-called war on terror are actually afraid of Muslim unity. They're afraid of the fact that the polls show that two-thirds of Muslims worldwide would like the Muslim-majority countries to become a confederation or a neo-caliphate. This, of course, would mean the end of Israel. So they've created this fake caliphate, or ISIS, to essentially slime the notion of the caliphate. They're poisoning the well so that whenever Muslims say, yeah, we want to have a caliphate, folks will say, oh, you're just a bunch of ISIS radicals. I bet you're going to chop off heads next. So that's how I interpret that story.
Well, imagine the American people being told for all these years that Al-Qaeda is the enemy and did all these terrible things in New York and Washington, and now it's quite clear that U.S. is allied with Al-Qaeda in Syria area. And how are we supposed to come to terms with that? So ISIS, are they being set up to be sort of puppet negotiators somewhere down the line? And we come to think of them, okay, they'll come to terms down the line. So what is ISIS, Daesh, what is it being set up to do? And, of course, the question always comes, you know, where is it getting its arms? Where is it getting its funding? Where is it getting its organizational backing and all these glossy publications that it puts out and whatnot? I mean, this basic question, the fact that our media just won't ask the most basic question, what are the historical roots? Who's funding it? Follow the money. It's so discrediting our major institutions in our society. It's hard to imagine how we're going to continue with that, this much lying and this much subterfuge and obfuscation taking place.
But we can see why the Western powers that be, led by the Zionists, are so happy to have the so-called Islamic State out there as a universal boogeyman. The next story shows that they're using that to up their intervention over in Libya. They're pressuring the so-called unity government in Libya, which is really just a coalition of warlords presiding over the disastrously destroyed country that NATO bombed into oblivion a little bit ago. And now they want to bring in more airstrikes, more NATO presence. But the Libyan government is not happy about this. The next slide, deployment fail, is an RT story showing that the 20 U.S. commandos who arrived at the Wateea Air Base in Libya in combat readiness were told by the Libyans to get the heck out of here. Just like in Iraq, the Iraqi government is saying, we don't want you, America. We don't want NATO. Get out of here. You guys are ISIS. You're pretending to fight ISIS, but you are ISIS. And that's exactly what the Libyans are telling them as well.
Of course, the removal of Muammar Gaddafi, I mean, Libya was a very stable country, providing for its people very well in the era when Muammar Gaddafi was the leader. I often used to hear about Muammar Gaddafi from Splitting the Sky. Muammar Gaddafi would fund the American Indian movement. He would fund the Black Panthers in the United States. Muammar Gaddafi was very closely connected to the Pan-African people, you know, the decolonization leadership south of the Sahara in Africa. So the removal of Muammar Gaddafi, there again, you have a somewhat sort of secular, powerful leader who's actually creating a kind of stable regime in his country, and that is removed, and the decision is made to take out Gaddafi and to fund and arm, you know, so-called rebel groups and Al-Qaeda or whatever, you know, Takfiri mercenary armies in Libya. And then these individuals then go into Syria and become, you know, supposedly the opponents of Assad. Anyway, all kinds of manipulations are taking place. So coming to terms with what actually happened in Libya is really, really important. And of course, Libya is a mess right now. Libya is destabilized and factionalized, and it seems that this is the, you know, the part of the New World Order, that this type of chaos is actually the objective in some parts of the world.
Including Yemen. Our next slide tells us that the New World Order is not doing so well in Yemen. The indigenous Yemeni forces led by the Houthi Liberation Movement, which it aims to expel NATO and the U.S. from Yemen, has killed over 80 Saudi-led troops, including 42 Blackwater mercenaries, in a missile attack. I was predicting last spring, Tony, that the Saudi invasion of Yemen was not going to work out well for the Saudis. It was going to be their Vietnam, and it looks like that's the case. The Saudis are desperate to figure out a way to put a happy face on their disastrous failure in Yemen, but they're not going to succeed at that.
Some refer to this situation in Yemen and the area as the new Cold War of the Middle East. And of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran facing Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, interestingly, you know, they seem to always be on the same page with Israel. There seems to be a very strong Israeli-Saudi axis. But Yemen becomes the kind of battleground in this new Cold War of the Middle East, and you know, the decimation and the disruption and the uprooting of Yemenis and the, you know, the human rights violations taking place there, the humanitarian crisis there, this doesn't get very much in the mainstream media in our countries, and that's part of, you know, the bias that we're dealing with and the fact that some people's lives are obviously made to count for a lot more than other people's lives. And brown-skinned people and Muslim people's lives, when they're decimated by the millions, but, you know, it doesn't seem to register very much on our consciousness, on our conscience, on our venues of reportage.
Well, the people getting in the way of Israeli expansionism one way or another don't seem to have lives that matter very much either. News this week, a Canadian was shot by an Israeli sniper in the West Bank. The Israeli snipers target people who have posed no threat, including children, as British Medical Journal found about a decade ago. They did a study of 600-plus sniper murders of children. IDF snipers were shooting to kill. They were killing Palestinian children for sport. Now they kill a Canadian, and guess what? I'll bet the Canadian government is not going to call them to account.
Actually, she's not killed. Rahab Nazal working on a PhD at the University of Western Ontario. She's Palestinian, and so she was shot a couple of weeks ago, taking pictures in that part of the world. And it's not clear to me who she was shot by, but it seems to me it might very well be a IDF, Israeli Defense Force shooter. So she's wounded and she's in the hospital, but this becomes very important diplomatically because, of course, we've had a change of government in Canada, and the government of Stephen Harper is no more. The government of Justin Trudeau is in place. So will Justin Trudeau, who seems to be very, you know, subject to the Zionist lobby or the Israeli lobby in Canada, will, you know, and he while he was in opposition, he would mostly mimic what the Harper government was saying in terms of its relations with Israel and the Palestinians. But now you've had a Canadian citizen shot, and will the Trudeau government intervene? So Peter Larson is writing a letter. This slide is actually based on a letter from Peter Larson asking the questions of the Canadian government. Will the Canadian government intervene appropriately in defense of the the rights of and the human rights of a Canadian citizen who also happens to be Palestinian? The new Minister of Foreign Affairs, Stéphane Dion, it's directed to Stéphane Dion, who was for a time leader of the Liberal Party of Canada, which is now the governing party. So this is an important test case for, you know, will there be a shift in policy from the government of Canada towards the government of Israel? And, you know, what could be a clear case in a Canadian citizen being shot in pursuit of, you know, while she's in pursuit of her duties, just shot by the Israeli government? If we can't protest that and take a strong stance on that, what could we take a stance on?
Well, we've heard a lot about Islamic extremism. In fact, we hear about it every day, much of it just smoke and mirrors. The question of Jewish extremism, though, is absolutely taboo. We're not allowed to talk about that. But there's obviously some serious Jewish extremism going on over in Israel. We heard from a religious leader in Israel, a Jewish religious leader, that Christians are blood-sucking vampires who need to be expelled from Israel. Sounds like the Israeli version of ISIS. In fact, if you realize that ISIS is, in fact, an Israeli creation, it all kind of makes sense. This kind of supremacist ideology is inherent to a certain extremist side of Judaism, which has come to full fruition in Israel.
Well, here's a nice Christmas story. Merry Christmas from Israel. Don't have any ceremonies. Don't have any Christian ceremonies in Israel. Keep your Christmas trees out of here. Your blood-sucking vampires, Christian, and, you know, don't have anything to do with this. Of course, Ben-Zion Gopstein is a student of Meir Kahane, and, you know, very much part of this very Talmudic interpretation where, you know, goys, non-Jews, are kind of a subspecies. And, so there's a very supremacist movement within Israel. There are progressive forces. Israel is a diverse place, but there's, you know, very extremist anti-goy philosophy afoot in some parts of Israel, and Ben-Zion Gopstein would epitomize that. He's director of something called Lahava, which is very much against any assimilation, really trying to prevent Jews from in any way being influenced by and assimilating into this, you know, diabolical Christian culture. So it's a story, of course, reported in Haaretz, and so much of the real news about what's going on in Israel comes out in this important newspaper, very informative and pretty balanced newspaper out of Israel.
Yeah, they actually expose Israeli extremism, although they don't really expose the full historical truth, which is that the entire Zionist project is an ultra-extremist project. It all goes back to Shabbatai Zvi and Jacob Frank in the 1600s. It's a fanatical, messianic, religious project to take over the world and establish a world capital in Jerusalem with Jews on top and all of the non-Jews of the earth reduced to the status of cattle. The Jewish Messiah will be the world dictator on the throne in Jerusalem. This is the interpretation of Judaism from Jacob Frank, Shabbatai Zevi. The Rothschild family is part of this same heretical branch of Judaism, and Zionism is the product of this kind of extremism. But you won't hear that from Haaretz or from anybody else in polite company. Next story, you will hear it from Iran, and Iran is bravely standing up against Zionism, telling the truth about Zionism, putting truth tellers on press TV to talk about Zionism. And Turkey, on the other hand, pretends to be anti-Zionist, but has very, very close ties with the Zionists, always has. Erdogan made some bizarre off-the-cuff remarks after the Mavi Marmara incident when Turkish nationals were murdered on board a ship that was attempting to break the blockade of Gaza. And at that point in 2009, Erdogan said that the Turkish Navy was planning to break that blockade. Then he backed off, and now the Turks are once again blowing their facade of supposedly turning anti-Zionist. They never turned anti-Zionist. They're cozying up with the Israelis, who basically own much of their military and intelligence service anyway, and Iran is telling them not to do that. Well, good luck, Iran. I'm afraid Turkey is back in the Zionist camp where it always was.
I first heard about the Mavi Marmara incident at a presentation given by Ken O'Keefe, who, you know, speaks in these types of venues often and is, you know, we've hung out with Ken in Iran. And Ken tells the story of being this ex-Marine on the Mavi Marmara, bringing in humanitarian aid into Gaza. And the IDF lands from helicopters. Commandos come onto the ship, and he disarms a couple of them. In the process, I think this was 2009, nine Turks were murdered in cold blood on the Mavi Marmara.
Including one U.S. citizen.
What's that?
Including one who was a U.S. citizen.
Is that right? And so there was a real cooling of relations between Turkey and Israel in the wake of this. So, you know, there was questions, would Turkey be, you know, realign itself and distance itself a little bit from Israel? But now that we see, you know, Turkey is a main center to supply and aid Daesh, the Takfiri mercenary army that is serving primarily Israel's geopolitical interests, and there is Iran fighting Daesh along with Russia. So there is Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, taking a position as a fellow Muslim-dominated country to Turkey. Don't do it. Don't enter into quote-unquote normalized relations with Israel.
And speaking of normalized relations with Israel, if Trump is elected, will he break off relations with Israel and declare war in retaliation for 9/11? Sounds unlikely, but that would be one interpretation of the big story that broke this week. Trump tells the crowd in Michigan, Grand Rapids, Michigan, that Martin Hill, who disrupted Trump's event by saying, Israel did 9/11, it was dancing Israelis celebrating 9/11, Trump, it wasn't dancing Muslims, Trump reacted very positively to Martin Hill's intervention. The only intervention among several protesters at that event that got a positive response from Trump. All the others, Trump slammed and basically told the security to throw those guys out. But when Martin Hill said, Israel did 9/11, it was the dancing Israelis, Trump, Trump stopped, let him speak, listened to him, and then responded positively by saying, he's a Trump guy, he's on our side. Tony, do you think that Trump might actually be a secret viewer of False Flag Weekly News?
Well, I think Trump may very well understand that there's an enormous constituency in the United States who know that 9/11 was an inside job. And, you know, he's in an interesting position as a politician. He's a wealthy person. He's not a beholden to rich donors. I noticed he was in a private meeting with Sheldon Adelson, who is kind of a mobster figure who controls the gambling casinos in the United States and Macau and other areas. You know, we all saw The Godfather, and we saw how the mafia was taken over by you know, sort of Jewish operatives, Mayor Lansky, and so there's a Sheldon Adelson with his hundreds of billions, who's made it clear that he's going to be the decider on who gets the nomination, the Republican Party nomination, and Trump doesn't seem to be, you know, he's not subject to Sheldon Adelson's control, and the two of them go into conference together. I found it interesting when Trump said, well, we're going to block Muslims, that got the attention, of course. He says, we've got to figure out what's going on. And yes, indeed, we do have to figure out what's going on. And
sounds like he is figuring out from this this story anyway.
So he is kind of a wild card. And the fact that, you know, I don't think it's inconceivable that you could ride to the presidency of the United States by actually truth-telling on this issue, that
well,
would.
Well, good luck with that, Tony. I don't know. We'll see how it all pans out.
Being overly optimistic?
I think so, because see, the overall thrust of what Trump has been saying has been to increase all kinds of, you know, racism and Islamophobia. For instance, let's whip through these Trump Islamophobia, Trump racism stories really fast, because we're almost at the end of the show and we still have 20 stories left. So we have the activist from Black Lives Matter, Mukherjee Southall Jr., who was kicked, punched, and choked by Donald Trump supporters at a rally in Birmingham, Alabama. I think he's like thinks he's having a bad acid trip flashback to the 1960s or something. And then we had these brothers up in Boston with the next slide who say that they were inspired by Donald Trump to start beating up Latino guys. Okay, that's great. I'm sure Trump is proud of that. And then we have the white supremacists saying that they're getting a big-time Trump bump. White supremacism has never seen better days thanks to the publicity coming out of Trump. And they cite David Duke in this story. Well, actually, David Duke is not quite the bogeyman that he's made out to be. Anybody who's seen him debating Alex Jones will have to admit that Duke wiped the floor with that neocon slime Alex Jones. In any case, it's interesting indeed.
That's Dr. Duke, I believe.
Yes, yes. So the white nationalist movement, which you know, I may have a point here and there, you know, I'm not 100% against people like Kevin MacDonald. He's an interesting truth teller, or at least a guy who's pursuing his own version of the truth outside the mainstream, down in Long Beach State, people like that. I listen to them on my radio show now and then, and I just hope that this kind of white nationalism doesn't turn into a kind of fascist violence targeting minorities, which is the sort of thing that we've seen happen in so many places in history. Well, we had a Trump supporter arrested for a plot to bomb Muslims. That was in Richmond, California. It's where I used to teach at Contra Costa College. I used to bicycle to work every day. So I can imagine that as a Muslim bicycling to work in Richmond, I'd be going by some guy's backyard where he's building a bomb to blow up mosques. Not good. And then we have the people who are being humiliated, detained at airports. A Jordanian was prevented from entering the U.S. even though he had a perfectly good visa for no particular reason. They just started mistreating him, and they threw him in a cell with a bunch of other people in the similar circumstances. He wrote up a report for this. It's posted at No Lies Radio. And then maybe you can talk about some of these others, Tony, the growing list of anti-Islam incidents since Paris. We had a very recent one last night where a family of, what, like 9, 10, 11 people coming to Disneyland from the UK was prevented from entering the U.S., apparently because they're Muslims, and one of them had the name of somebody who'd been put on the no-fly list.
Yeah. Of course, we ran into this in Paris where we went to this mainstream conference, Islamophobia and the Erosion of Civil Society. And we wanted to talk, to introduce into this formal proceedings, the idea that Islamophobia is, you know, being engineered and created through the engineering creation of false flag events. And, you know, we ran into a kind of wall, very solid academics and who were presenting at the conference, people who get criticized a lot by the Zionist lobby, and their funding is called into a question, and you know, they face a lot of they're on the edges. But it was very interesting to see the kind of frontiers, the outer frontiers of what the formal academy was prepared to talk about and what they weren't prepared to talk about. So Paris, I think we'll stick with Paris as a very important sort of venue for this whole psychological operation, and develop our own psychological operation with respect to these double events in Paris that you now are, you know, about to have two books highlighting.
Well, exposing the truth about these false flags, I think, is the best way to fight back. Over at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, we've seen Mohamedou Ould Slahi, a Mauritanian who is the author of a bestseller in multiple languages. His Guantanamo Diary has been spread all over the world. It's a compilation of essays he wrote in Cuba in Guantanamo in 2005. It was originally intended for his lawyers to help with his case, but now it's become an international bestseller. But it looks like he's lost his appeal. He's slated to spend his life locked up for no reason, charged with no crime, simply because, what, he had the wrong name, somebody put a bounty on him. Tony, you think that Guantanamo is ever going to close? In our next slide, we see Obama is indeed saying that he might be able to close it on his own. You think that's going to happen?
Well, who knows? In the last period of a president's second term, strange things can happen. But let's put Guantanamo in historical context. I mean, so you had this, suddenly you had after 9/11 this global war on terror, and you had to produce some terrorists. And so the way I see Guantanamo, you just went around and gathered up some people and put them on display in the camp in Guantanamo, which interestingly is also in Cuba, and kind of making a point that you know, the USA has this kind of muscular ability to even, you know, put prisoners in Cuba. And the point of it is that, well, look, we've got terrorists. Look, we've got a camp full of these people in yellow suits, and they have Muslim names, and they have brown skin, and look, don't they look like terrorists? And then when you get people inside these camps, then you start to, you know, deal with them and psychologically play with them. So we know that Daesh, you know, one of the roots of Daesh or ISIL or ISIS is what was going on in the prisons, in the U.S. prisons in Iraq, and people were being played and developed as assets in different ways. So anybody who releases the prisoners in Guantanamo will be accused, oh my goodness, you're letting all these wild and crazy people loose on society, and they're going to go and rape and pillage wherever they go. But that's not what Guantanamo is about. All this stuff about, well, we have to torture people. No, you're not torturing people to find out where'd you put the bomb, where'd you put the bomb. You're torturing people to admit to things under torture, like in the 9/11 report, which then proves, look, we've got evidence. We've got this, this, and this person actually saying they did this, this, and this. So the whole fraudulent nature of this global war on terror, Guantanamo was a major sort of Hollywood installation to demonstrate that it was real when it wasn't.
And that kind of propaganda, dumbing people down and putting them in fear so they can't stand up and defend their own interests, it's happening all over the world as we create this global police state on the back of Islamophobia. Over in Spain, the December 20th elections have turned into a farce, just like the recent French elections. It's another case, sort of like Greece, where people who've just been looted and pillaged by the globalists are confused, dumbed down, and fragmented, and so it looks like that they haven't stood up for their own interests in that election.
Yeah, this article by Peter Koenig, I found it quite fascinating. He reminds us, of course, that Spain had a fascist government, Falangist government, under Marco from the 1930s and the Civil War until 1975, when Franco died. And so this sort of fascist heritage to Spain is kind of showing itself now. And the new mark of the sort of fascist approach to government is austerity. You know, so you strip out the economy to give bailouts and such to the banksters, and then say, now we don't have any money for social programs, for education, for healthcare. Austerity, austerity, austerity. We're not going to have minimum wage laws. We're not going to have labor laws. And you strip out the society. And that's what this author suggests is taking place in Spain right now after these elections.
And there's plenty of money for things like using weather modification as a clandestine warfare program. The CIA is flush with drug money or taxpayers' money or whatever money it is for that. It seems like there's more money than ever for destroying our liberties and building up militarized police states everywhere, but there's no money to help people live basic, decent lives. Education, infrastructure, all that stuff is falling apart. Welcome to the brave new world. And speaking of which, hey, Merry Christmas, homeless people. 15 American cities are destroying homeless camps just days before Christmas. So I guess the Scrooges in charge of these cities are essentially saying, you're going to celebrate Christmas frozen to death. Tony, it's an outrage.
You can't have a job. You know, you can't have health care. You can't have good education for your kids. And, well, can we at least have a homeless camp? You know, somewhere we can have a campfire at night and get some warmth and at least some human company. And no, you can't have that either. No more.
Well, at least they didn't call in airstrikes.
What's that?
They didn't call in drone strikes on these homeless camps. But guess what? 41% of Trump voters do want to send a Merry Christmas greeting to the fictional city of Agrabah. That's the fictional town from Aladdin. It doesn't exist in reality. It's a cartoon town that 41% of Trump voters want to send their Christmas message to Agrabah by bombing it into smithereens.
Maybe we can have a Disney special on, you know, Christmas Day, and we'll watch a fantasy of this bombing. And maybe we can focus on a good little American family who happened to be there and get caught up in it and see the American family taken care of and somehow saved by the Marines, and everything will be okay.
You know, this segment of the electorate really should get to just sit down and stare at their TV and watch cartoon cities being bombed, and we should just keep them happy that way, and we should stop bombing real people.
Yeah, and paying people to cut one another's head off and something, because that really gets people.
Yeah, right. And, you know, Christianity and Islam have so much in common. Today there's so much propaganda trying to terrorize Christians about the evil, scary Muslims. One of the things they have in common is that they're both the two main forms of universal monotheism. And this year, the founders of the two religions are having their birthdays celebrated on virtually the same day. Maulid an-Nabi, which is the celebration of the birth of Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, is happening the same time as Christmas, the celebration of the birth of Jesus, or at least that's what it's supposed to be. You wouldn't know that from going to Walmart and looking at the people running around buying all kinds of consumer goods, but hey, there you go. So, Merry Christmas, happy Maulid an-Nabawi to all of you universal monotheists out there, and indeed to everybody else as well. Tony, though, what's this about UFOs over Jesus' head? This is a story that Alan from No Lies sent us right at the last minute. I didn't get a chance to look into this and figure out whether I actually believe that there was a UFO over Jesus' head. What do you think?
Well, there seems to be a lot of UFO action observed around Bethlehem, and you know, Stephen Greer and his Disclosure Project. Well, let's see if there really is something to this allegation that the U.S. military is covering up a lot of information about contacts that have actually been made with extraterrestrials. You know, Jesus, well, the Muslims recognize Jesus as one of the prophets, Noah and Moses, and the prophet, peace be upon him. You would think there would be a much closer understanding between Christians and Muslims, where Jews, of course, don't recognize Jesus as a prophet and him as a false, as some kind of a mental illness, manifestation of the mental illness of Christians. So you would think the tension between Judaism and Christianity would be greater, and the camaraderie and sense of our fellow human beings trying to understand the mystery of living in this universe, that the Christians and Muslims would have a great deal in common. And I think we do, Kevin.
Whether or not that halo over Jesus' head is actually a UFO, Jesus clearly was coming with an incredible message. And that's really the issue, I think, is the ethical and spiritual message at the root of these great faiths. So, Merry Christmas, Happy Maulid, and may 2016 be a better year. Whether or not it's the year of disclosure, it's going to be a year of False Flag Weekly News. I'm Kevin Barrett with Tony Hall. We will be back in the future, God willing, with more False Flag Weekly News for you every week right here on No Lies Radio. So until the next one, see you then.